Hello, everybody. Is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm Dominique Weiss. I'm the trouble in the corner there. I'm a geochemist. So I'm going to try to give you some rationale of why isotopes can be useful. But before we do that, I want to come back to the phase diagram. And I'd like everybody to put their phone and computer down. And turn around. First, try to place where you are in this phase diagram. Turn backwards, except the last row, and talk to one or two, three people next to you to see where they are, where you are now, and where you'd like to go or be at the end of this meeting. Well, turn around. Okay, let's come back. We'll come back to that. And Vet, for your education, this is where the eutectic was coming, to simplify things a little. So where I'm going is that to move forward, we need to break some boundaries. And what I'm going to show you at the end are examples of some recent works we have been carried on Hawaii. Lauren Harrison modeling the Northwest Hawaiian Ridge, so going back in time, and then recent work on Kauai and Makapu. I don't think I'll get there. I will also show you what it takes to get good data. And Vet gave a perfect introduction to what I'm going to talk about, because we spend a lot of time, contrary to what you alluded to, as geochemists to ensure that our data is very precise and not drawing a line across everything. Also, I have to mention that this is my first CIDR, and I wished I had been here before. I'm having great fun and learning a ton. So to go back and put things in a context, I'm going to start with this frame of reference, which we call the charts of the nuclides. And what we have here is the proton numbers versus the neutron numbers and all the stable configuration. I forgot to mention that there are two very good summary of the application of radiogenic isotopes in mantle geochemistry. They indicated on the first slide. And quite a few of my pictures are taken from Bill White's Introduction to Geochemistry book. So what the black dots here represent are the stable configuration. And when we talk about isotopes, we talk about chemical elements that have the same numbers of protons, but different numbers of neutrons. What does that mean? That means that in mineral phases, at least for the heavy isotopes, they all behave exactly the same. There is no fractionation. I'll come back to that. You also see that this curve is not following a one-to-one line, and that's why you have strange numbers. Here you have carbon 12. Carbon is 6 protons, 6 neutrons. That's 12. 13, it's 6 protons, 7 neutrons. But when you go up there, like uranium, you have, for instance, uranium-238 with 92 protons and many more neutrons. I'll show you in a minute why I think that's important. You can also see that as you go up into this chart of nuclides with masses, at the low masses, you basically follow in the one-to-one line, and you have few isotopes combinations. And intermediate mass, you start having more. The color code is that blue is stable, red is very unstable. And what's white, it's not stable at all. And when you get to the very high masses, you have more and more combination of isotopes and more instability.
Why do some of the squares have two colors?
Because they can have... Because what? No. Because they can have different half-life depending on which combination. For this very unstable. Like here, for instance, 2004, we take as I think the combination here, for instance, for 204 lead, is some is artificial and some is not.
So the ones that are colored with white,
yeah,
do they have a natural occurrence or they are all sort of lab created ones? The very short half-life
so
boxes.
So everything that's out here,
yeah,
they were formed originally, or some of them have been formed in the nucleosynthesis but disappear instantaneously because of instability. So when we say they're instable, it means that they usually go towards a more stable configuration by decay. And there are three modes of decays, or four modes of decays, reflected here in this diagram conceptually. You have the alpha decay, where you change in Z by 2. You also lose 2 neutrons, so your mass number is changed by 4. You can gain a proton, so you change clearly chemical elements, because here are your same chemical elements. So alpha, you're going down 2 and down 2. It's a big difference. That type of decay happens only for the heavy elements. You can have one proton, gain one proton in the nucleus. You lose one neutron. It's called beta minus decay, with the emission of a negative ion. Beta plus, which could also be called electronic capture. You change your chemical elements. Those decay follow very specific rules. And that's just to simplify the perspective. Let's say you start here. In orange, we have the parent. And in green, we have what we call the daughter atoms. So your parent decays, meaning you're losing some of them, you're losing the number of atoms. And the rate of decay of an unstable parent at any time is proportional to the number of that parent existing at that time. So time 0 and 0, after a given time, you have n. And we have a way to measure this, which is the decay constant. The bottom line is, or the inverse of the decay constant is the half-life. It's the time it takes for half of the unstable parents to decay. So you start with 100, and after one half-life, you're at 50. After two half-life, you're at 25 of your parents. If you have a closed system, which for our purpose is clearly necessary, you're going to accumulate the same in the daughter atoms. What you see too is that depending on the, it doesn't take many half-life to run out of the parent. And so depending on the length of the half-life, some elements have disappeared. We'll come back to that. And another way to look at this is like this. you start at T0, you have your parents, and sometimes you have a natural abundance of your daughter isotopes. It doesn't have to be zero, or it's not always zero. It is zero often, for instance, if you deal with potassium argon decay, where you have argon, which is a noble gas, doesn't have a tendency to be in the minerals. So that's a good situation to start with zero daughter at the beginning of your clock. So after one half-life, after two half-life, and so on. So we can put an equation to that, which is that the amount of daughter product produced is proportional to what's present initially, plus the quantity of the parent, times E lambda T minus 1, lambda being the decay constant, and T being the time period that went through. Now, we usually express this equation as ratio, because with our mass spectrometers, we measure isotopic ratios rather than absolute abundance. Is it clear so far? So where do we go with this? So that equation we call the isochrone equation. And in a plot where you have d over d prime, so your daughter over a stable isotope of the daughter versus your parent over the stable isotope of the daughter, this equation is a line. And I'm going to show you that. Let's take one example. I take a simple example, rubidium strontium. So we have our parent, which is the 87 isotope of rubidium that's unstable, decaying in strontium 87. That's a beta minus. So you change your chemical elements, and you gain one proton and you lose one neutron. You keep the same A. The stable isotope of strontium is 86. So we put those isotopes into the equation. Radiogenic isotope of strontium versus stable isotope of strontium, the initial ratio, the parent-daughter ratio, which are a direct function of the relative abundance of these elements, and then E lambda rubidium 87 times T minus 1. So in this XY plot, we have Y, the isotopic ratio, is equal to the intercept in Y plus XM, the slope of the line. So if you have a closed system, you're going to have a straight line, where, I'll just describe that, X is the parent-daughter ratio, Y is the isotopic ratio, and the slope is entirely proportional to the age. Lambda is a constant, and every single isotope that is radiogenic has a single constant decay. It doesn't vary. That reflects law of nuclear physics. The other thing that's very important is the intercept. And that's where that introduction to error comes into play, because that's what we do with our isochrone plot. So what does it look like? At T equals zero, so you crystallize your system, because you're dealing with the same chemical elements, you have a homogeneous source. It is completely homogeneous. That doesn't disturb anybody? I'm fine, but ask questions if you have any. So same isotopic ratio, but because your rock is going to be made up of different minerals, you're going to have different proportion of your rubidium and strontium. Yes, Chishu?
So can you tell us what is that ratio, is that a wet ratio or molar ratio?
What ratio?
So what is the rubidium strontium ratio? Is that the wet ratio or the molar ratio? I ask this question for the students.
The what ratio? Molar. Students? Geochemistry students, please help. Yeah, and you multiply that by the abundance of the element. So you need to know the abundance of your isotopes and the abundance in ppm of your element.
Is the decay constant completely insensitive to pressure temperature change?
For our purposes, yes. Not for the nuclear physicists to study the nucleosynthesis, but for what we deal with in this using this radioactive clock, they are. So far, nobody has documented that for the system we use, and I'll show them, they are variable. It doesn't mean they're all well known, but that's another story. Okay? So we start here, homogeneous isotopic ratio. Different, so if you have one rock with different minerals, depending the minerals you have in, you will have different rubidium strontium ratio. Or if you have many rocks, depending on the proportion of the different minerals, you're going to have a variation in your rubidium strontium ratio. And so what's happening with time? Where do you think it goes with time, with decay? Which direction are we going? Straight up, that way, that way, that way, correct. We're going that way because I'm talking about a closed system. We have one rubidium 87 that's going to decay into one strontium 87. And the more rubidium you have, the more strontium you'll produce. And so after your time T, if your system has remained closed, you end up forming a line. And in this diagram, the slope here is E lambda T minus 1. And so all you need to do, in quotes, is measuring your parent-daughter ratios in your sample and your isotopic composition, and you can establish the age of the rock. All in quotes. Huh? It's not that simple. Could put it on the table.
I'm just a little confused. Why again do you use strontium 86 as your denominator?
Because we need, it's a very good question. In our instruments, mass spectrometers, we measure ratios. We don't measure absolute abundance. And so we use a stable isotope reference. In the case of strontium, it's 86 as a reference ratio to get our ratios.
Why is it the reference, though?
Why is it what?
Like, why do you choose that as your reference? What about strontium 85? I don't know.
There is no strontium 85.
There is an
88. There is an 88 and there is an 84. And there is an 84. You're choosing, it's a very good question. You're choosing an isotope that is abundant enough, that also has no interference by another isotope. Remember, so we use mass spectrometers, so we analyze our ions on the basis of their mass, and it only discriminates the mass. So anything that has, if you don't have, and that's why I was putting in quote when we crush our samples and then analyze them, we have to have pure solutions as much as possible, because if you have another mass another element that will have an isotope at the same mass, you're going to create an interference. So you pick something that is clean enough.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but another reason is in theory you could use any stable isotope, but mass spectrometers, you get more precise results if the ratio is close to one, and so you want to choose one that's not, they'll make a ratio closer to one, get better precision.
Yep. Okay, so this looks very simple. There is something else that's very important in our equation, is our intercept here. The intercept gives you the initial ratio of your system, which is the ratio of your source. I'll come back to that, but that's basically what we use, and I'll keep doing this with the fingerprint. I'll explain to you why we're doing this. But before we do that, I'd like to make you think a little bit at this difference between isotope homogenization and elemental fractionation. And this is a silly example designed by Francis Albaret in his Introduction to Geochemistry book, where you have white cats and black dogs. That's different elements. And the cats climb in the tree. The dogs are just barking at the bottom. Some dogs will climb, but that's another story. They differentiate. They fractionate. They cannot all go in the same system. While if you have cats, black and white cats, they're going to randomly go everywhere. And if you have a big population, which is what we have with our atoms in our system, you end up being completely homogenized. Okay? Keep. Just to make sure that you have a question to ask. You good with that? So that's the difference between the elemental behavior and the isotope behavior. Yes?
I guess, aren't there ways where you don't get this homogenization of isotopes? Like, I guess using this picture, I could imagine that if instead of black and white cats, you had like fat cats and skinny cats, the skinny cats might be preferentially up in the tree.
Can you hold on to your question? I'm getting there. So what the systems we have at hand for our Earth studies are basically summarized here, and that's an old slide from a Dickens book, where you can see we have different systems with different half-life, going from 1 million years to 1 billion years and then longer. No need to say that all these are basically useless, because if they decay, we don't have a sampling period long enough to see any changes. If you have something that has an half-life of 10 to the 15, I don't even know what that is. It's 1,000 billion years, correct? It's going to take, 1,000 billion years with this half-life taking, so it takes half the time to you see where I'm going. You're not going to see a signal of the radiogenic daughter. So we have a series of systems, and not very many. Basically, and my talk is going to be focused on the use of these radioactive systems. I'm going to deal with your fractionation in a minute. These are basically the ones that are the most common and that we can use. And you can see that we are limited in a range of half-life that is somewhat proportional to the age of the Earth. We have uranium-238 decaying in lead-206 that has an half-life that's about the age of the Earth. you have the 235 uranium decaying in 207 lead that has an half-life of 700 million years. It basically means that all our uranium-235 that was present initially is gone. That creates a big problem for the nuclear industry, but that's another story. We can talk about that. So that's two different isotopes of the same chemical element decaying in two different isotopes of the same chemical elements, lead. And I'm emphasizing this because I'm going to use lead a lot. You have potassium-40 decaying into argon-40, and you see that it's also decaying in calcium-40. That's what's called a branch decay. You can have both. This one is the most abundant isotope of calcium. So anything that's coming from the decay of potassium-40 is completely lost in a huge, you can't see the signal. So we always use potassium-40, argon-40. Yes?
So you said it can decay into either argon or calcium, right?
It's called a branch decay, and all the decays are completely random. Meaning if you have a million potassium-40, you can't point at one and know that it's that one that's going to decay. But you know that among your million isotopes of argon-40, of potassium-40, in a given time period, a given proportion will decay into potassium-40, and a given proportion will decay in argon-40.
But you can't know which one it will be.
If you need to look at many, but you can't predict which one of these isotopes in your many, many, many present anyway will decay. It's a Poisson process. So why is this important? And I know you guys hate the periodic table. I used to hate it too. First I have this. That's part of your answer. So we have abundance of isotopes. We have in red what I talked about, long-lived radioactive isotopes, those that have an half-life that are greater than 100 million years. So at the beginning of nucleosynthesis, you're producing your isotopes. You keep producing them, but they decay. And then when the nucleosynthesis stopped, or the collapse of the solar nebula, you start decaying. Because the half-life is slow enough, you still have some today. Sujoy, whenever that was, Monday, talk about the short-lived extinct radioactive isotopes. Those are the ones that have a short half-life, and those are the ones that have completely decayed today, but we still have some traces of either their parent or some of the changes in the composition that they induce. And then you have what we call stable isotopes, which are these blue guys. They keep being produced, so they grow. When the production stops, they are stable. Their composition is not varying. And that's most of the isotopes. So, the short-lived extinct are always in low abundance. Yes?
I have a dumb question. So I know that
there's no dumb question.
Yeah. Thank you. So I know that the natural abundance of 57 iron is 2%, roughly. Is it possible that that natural abundance can change in different stars, for example, depends on like
yes.
process that makes...
We'll get to that in two slides, I think.
Yes.
So here's our periodic table. Yeah.
Why? Can you just go back? Why is the growth of the radioactive isotopes exponential when nucleosynthesis starts? Yeah.
That has to do with the production. I don't know why it's exponential. The decay is exponential. I don't know why the growth is exponential.
It's also decaying in the...
Yeah, it is decaying as it's being produced.
Yes,
that's right.
Oh, okay.
So it's a combination of that line and that line, which gives you that. So these are, and I want to show that to you. I forgot to mention that I completely reorganized my talk on the basis of the questions I've heard since I've been here to try to bring us together and break our boundaries and make sure we understand each other. So, Alf Lahoum didn't have petrology. Can I assume that you all have had basic chemistry and remember the principle of the periodic table? Yes? No? So who didn't? So keep asking questions. Don't be ashamed. The bottom line is that we have our chemical elements here distributed on the basis of their properties. But so what do you see here with our hydrogenic systems? Where are they in the periodic table? Are they everywhere? Where do you see them?
Bottom.
Well, that's not really the bottom, huh? That's... Yes, they are heavy because the higher you go up in your Zn combination, the more unstable you have. But that's not where I was going. It's also that you are on the extremes. And what are these extremes in terms of their chemical properties or geochemical properties? What do they do? Are they reactive? Are they not reactive? Yeah. So, well, those are the noble gas. I'll let Sujo and Rita talk about that. But those are very reactive, both of them. The alkalis and the alkaline earth are very reactive. So that's important. They also, you can see, let me come back to this if I need to. This is the same table, it's only one, but organized with the geochemical properties of these elements on top of having the chemical families, where you have the lithophile elements. So those are, and Sujo touched on that, I think, those are the ones going into rocks, little, they like rocks. And so all these guys are actually very concentrated in the Earth's crust. These two, to a lower extent. You have those in the middle here are not, they sort of not very distinctive. And what I'm getting at is that you have a very, we actually are quite limited in which of these hydrogenic systems we can use. And most of them are concentrated in the crust, meaning they all these elements are not very abundant in the mantle. Luckily, we have the rare earth. And the reason why I don't want to put them at the bottom here is because you could picture you need to picture a 3D periodic table because they all have the same outer electron structure and they all behave the same, basically, in Earth. The only variation here is the size because you increase your element, so you shrink. But in terms of the electronic configuration, it's like they're pointing at you. They're also very stable, they're not mobile, they don't suffer alteration, as rubidium and potassium do, for instance. So those constitute very good systems. But if you go back to the table I showed you, we don't have very many, and they have relatively long half-life. Okay, more questions? We call them the rare earth. It's not really a good term because they're not specially rare. Also, very soon we're going to discuss that with the distribution of the rare earth on a world scale for batteries, but that, again, that's another story. You good? Okay. So, and I'm getting to my answer to you. When we talk about isotopes, we consider different categories. We use, so it's always, isotopes are always the same. Huh? It's same Z, different N, same chemical properties, slight mass difference. The radiogenic isotopes are, we're going to look at the heavy ones, or relatively heavy, and we look at the isotopic composition that reflects the origin of the sample. That's what we call, that's what we use for the fingerprinting of the source, because we have our initial ratio. The stable isotopes, and in the past we only dealt with light stable isotopes, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, can be fractionated because the relative mass difference is big, they light. So if you make the difference between oxygen 18 and oxygen 16, it's a small mass, the relative mass difference between 16 and 18 is big compared, for instance, to uranium-238 and uranium-235. So those can fractionate by natural processes such as evaporation, diffusion, and things like that. Also biological, carbon-13, carbon-12 are fractionated by different organisms. So in this case, when you have fractionation, it's more reflecting a process than a source. Except that now we have a lot of, over the last 15 years, there has been a lot of development of mass spectrometers, and we can basically measure the isotopic composition of the whole periodic table, as Roberta alluded to and showed a few examples. So the blue are the, they call them, it's a stupid denomination, and we all struggle with what to call them. The light stable isotopes, well, sulfur is not really stable, but that's the one that we have been able to measure for years. And then the non-traditional stable, I made this is relatively old, it's 2004. Now we can basically measure everything. The point I want to emphasize is that the extent of your isotopic variation, reflected here by your delta M over M, is decreasing as you go up in atomic number. And you can see that those differences are very difficult to measure. So where I'm going, and that's where I'm answering your question, you have very little fractionation here, and for some of the element, the isotopes, we can't even measure them yet. So we don't use them. And basically, that's where we are now. As of 2 years ago, I should update this. That's all the isotopes, the non-traditional stable isotopes that are being measured. We can add vanadium if it's not, yeah, vanadium is not there yet. Basically, we can measure everything. But those are tracing processes. I'm going to now on talk about the radioactive isotopes that generate radiogenic isotopes that reflect the time integration of the source and that fingerprint the source.
Can you go back a slide? So I understand that this is an observation that you can't measure, or it's more difficult to measure isotopes that are with a very low delta M over absolute M. But I don't understand why that is the case. Like, because isn't the change in mass between the isotopes is going to be about one in all cases, isn't it? or am I misunderstanding what delta M is on this plot?
Yeah, so the delta M, like in our strontium, for instance, we measure of 87, 86. So it's delta M is 1 divided by 86. So in the case of lead, for instance, we have 208, 206, 207, 206 over 204. So our delta M is 1 or 2 divided by 204.
Yes, I understand
so that's
that.
Getting small. Oops, sorry.
But if you're in a spectrometer, you're measuring the difference between masses. So why does it matter if, what the absolute mass is?
What matters is that because that difference is very small, the higher your Z is.
Oh, okay. The relative
difference. Yeah, they're not fractionated. You know, the difference is too small to be fractionated by natural processes, by evaporation, and all this that's fractionating the diffusion, that's fractionating the light isotopes, cannot fractionate the heavy. Okay. And that's why it's so, it's a parenthesis, but it's of interest. That's why it's so difficult to enrich uranium so that you can put it into a nuclear reactor.
It's kind of amazing, you know, as our ability to measure smaller and smaller things improves. They're now measuring stable isotopic fractionation of uranium isotopes, yeah. For example. That's become a very important tool, in fact. And
disturbing tool.
Yeah, because we always assume, oh, it's always the same ratio of 235 to 238. It's actually yeah. not. It varies within yeah. nature. But we didn't know. I mean, we couldn't measure that until fairly recently, those variations. So these are non-radiogenic. These are not due to radioactive decay. They're due to physical processes, like Dominique said, evaporation or condensation or diffusion can also cause fractionation.
Yeah, and some of the intermediate metals, for instance, iron, molybdenum, vanadium, might be fractionated among mineral phases. But so you're tracing a process. You need a mineral phase to fractionate. In the case of iron, for instance, crystallizing in mafic rocks, you need to crystallize magnetite or ilmenite that are iron-bearing minerals to fractionate iron. If you don't crystallize those minerals, the simple differentiation of your rocks is not changing anything. And you're going to have the same iron signal. So the that's what I'm trying to do here, we're dealing with completely different tools to do different things. I'm not saying those are not useful, but I don't want to talk about that, no. I'm trying to convince you about the use of the radiogenic isotopes. This is relevant, and sorry, a follow-up of what Sujo showed, and I think it's important. It also has to do, if you put that back to the periodic table that I showed you, these are the solar abundance of the elements. And what I want to emphasize here is the range. We start, and it's a log scale, normalized to silicon equal a million here. 10 to the 6th, yeah. So you have hydrogen and helium that represent 99% of the solar system. And then after that, you basically, the heavier your element is, the less abundant it is. And this is actually fundamental, and I could spend an hour just talking about that, because it has major implication for the resources we have, but also for many of the tools we have. But let's not go there. The part I want to emphasize here is that as you go up in Z, you may, in the nuclear synthesis process, you make these elements by different mechanisms. Primordial nucleosynthesis, you have hydrogen and helium. And then, let's skip those. If you combine hydrogen and helium, that's what we call the fission nuclear energy, you go up here, and then you fission this, you go to that, you burn helium, you form carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, You burn those, you go up here, and that's how you go up. Up to 1 pound, which is here. So you can fuse your existing elements up to the iron peak. After that, you have another. It's the repulsion of your protons that are very, very tight in your nucleus is too strong, and you cannot add a lot. You cannot go up in elements by fission anymore. The way you go up is by neutron captures, what's called the SNR process. And that the reason why I wanted to mention that, because that's how you form these potentially anomalies in the neodymium-142. That's how you potentially form heterogeneities in the very early solar system. It's through these processes. Question?
So I think you're trying to just keep those three elements there, but why are they plotting so low?
They're so low because, and maybe somebody else, that, Sarah, can you explain that? No? They basically destructed. Yeah. Yeah.
So lithium is destroying charge.
Yeah.
To make beryllium, you have to do helium plus helium plus helium, which is a free body interaction, which is very difficult to carry out. So that explains why lithium and beryllium are so low. I don't know another form.
And they're also consumed by the fusion reactions.
Yeah. They burned instantaneously. And you see, so their abundance is very, very low. Now, there's something else that's very striking in this curve. What do you find the most striking, and not a geochemist?
Iron.
Yeah, there is iron, and then what else?
Very regular up-down.
Yeah, the sawtooth pattern. The wiggles that are very irregular. So, the reason why iron is the most abundant is because, and that's why it's called the iron peak, if you look at the building energy per nucleon in mega electron volt, and I like to emphasize that, so we're talking about 10 to the 6 a million electron volt. So the nuclear binding energy is a million times stronger than the chemical bonding. And that's why we can assume that the decay constant is indeed a constant. As you see, as you go up to iron, your binding energy per nucleon keeps increasing. That's the fusion. Fusion. Now, after that, as I said, it doesn't work. And the way it worked, so you, that's the fission. You have all these heavier elements being very unstable. When they break into almost even components, you also recuperate energy. And that's why you have the peak of iron. About 10 to 100 times, or the iron peak, which are all these elements, about 10 to 100 times more abundant than their neighbor. It's, yes?
Does it mean that physics will apply to other exoplanet systems? So other exoplanet systems, although the major elemental ratio may change, but iron still remains as a dominant player. Could you make that statement?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't make that statement, but that's a valid assumption to make. The zigzag has to do with the fact that for nuclear binding, and it's partly related to the spin, is that the even elements, the combination of even, is more stable and has just to do with stability, is more stable than odd. So that zigzag actually reflects the fact that any element with an even Z is more abundant than its neighbor that has an odd Z. And for that especially, this is why, teasing you, this is why when we do the elements plot and extended trace element plot, we normalize to an abundance of something we know to get rid of the zigzag plot, the zigzag pattern, because it's disturbing.
So in this plot, the abundance of chromium and nickel are fairly lower than iron, but in the previous plot, the fusion energy is very similar. So why don't we see similar abundances if they're so close on this plot?
This is a big variation, but this is a relatively big difference. And the heavier, remember, the heavier you get, the harder it is to make an element. That's why you have a log scale. I mean, you basically decrease. Look at that. You go from hydrogen, which is above 10 billion here, down to, so you have a 10 to the 12th scale in the abundance of the element as you go down.
Chrome, iron, and nickel are all even numbered, and they're like two orders of magnitude lower on this plot, but in the binding energy, they're not. They're
I just want to make a general comment, just to remember this chart in the future, is that you might see how rare beryllium is, for example. So you might as well give somebody a barrel with beryllium that something made of carbon, like a diamond, because you might as well give them a bunch of helium. So what you should try to remember that when you are giving away rocks to people.
I think you lost us, Stefan.
Diamonds are not that incredibly rare because they're just made of carbon.
You have a good question. The answer is probably in the law of physics and what it takes to go from iron to nickel.
But that wouldn't explain to me why chromium is lower than nickel.
Yeah, well, we should focus on that, but that's not the purpose of my talk.
I mean, it's also
it's
a combination of things, right? It's not just
you have to remember it's a combination of things. It's not just the binding energy. That would be if everything was kind of in equilibrium, there would be everything would be proportional to the binding energy. But you know, you have like a limited number of things to put together, and this is clearer at low mass numbers. You know, If there's no two things you can put together to make the make a different isotope, it's not going to get made. And so with nickel versus its neighbors, you have to think about like how this will get created in the supernova and how likely the particular process that creates it is. It's not just a matter of the binding energy.
I actually had a detail of the whole process. It has also to do with the amount of energy you have at a given time. And for instance, when you fuse your helium and hydrogen, you're going to go up, but then gravity will come in and you're going to collapse, but you need the collapse to re-release. So it's all a stepwise process, and that's why my various circles reflect. And that happens only in some way. It doesn't happen everywhere because not all the supernovas have maybe the supernovas have the high energy, Sujo can confirm that, but not every star has enough energy to go up in the whole periodic table. So, gosh, we are now into it. How do we go from there to Earth, and what application can we do? So what we have here is what we call the bulk silicate Earth. So it's the whole Earth without the core and all our chemical elements. Again, in a log scale abundance. And basically what you see is that you only have a few elements, those are the major elements, that are the most abundant. And if you add the core, you're going to add iron and nickel, and that's it. Everything else in the periodic table on Earth are trace elements, meaning they have abundance that are smaller than 0.1%. That doesn't help us geochemists. Well, it does, because those trace elements, that's what Esteban talked about, you can use the fractionation. So that's the cats and the dogs, depending on their masses and the chemical behavior, so which families they belong. But in terms of a hydrogenic system, we do not have too much. When we jump to the continental crust, we have even more fractionation. So how do we deal with that, and what can we use? Well, you know this better than I do. The Earth is 80, the mantle is 84% of the volume of the Earth. And how much have we sampled? Well, first, with a depth of 2,800 kilometers, I try to put that in a context. Driving from Vancouver to here by the shortest route would not take me to the core. The detour we made by the coast is still not taking us to the core. And I basically have to drive all across Canada, and remember this V shape, because that's really what you have, to basically reach the core. And so as geologists, well, and then an important point, we do not have very many direct samples. The deepest hole that was drilled was in the Kola Peninsula, and it was only 12.2 kilometers. And they were very disappointed because this basically were stuck in continental crust. On top, there was folding, and they didn't go through everything. So 12 kilometers versus 2,800. I need samples to analyze the isotopic composition. So what do we do? Well, we try to drill, and people keep trying to drill. Last year, they had another mission to go drill trying to reach the mantle at the mid-oceanic ridge. They failed again. They need kilometers, 10 kilometers of drilling equipment to try to reach the mantle. And everything always fails because, well, first you have your diamond-headed drill bits and you don't. So we use approximation. That's why we use our geochemistry. And I'm going to try to show you now basically two examples. Why can't we use isotopes? So if we look at the oceanic crust, we have a problem to go back in time. So I gave you the abundance of the solar system. We have the abundance today that we think are in the mantle and in the crust. How can we go back in time? Well, that's what Roberta is doing, studying the continental crust. But that's not how we're going to learn much about the mantle, or we learn indirectly. The oceanic crust, the oldest one, is basically 200 million years. That doesn't take us very far. Now, we have some obducted oceanic crust, so some fragments of oceanic crust on Earth, but still, that's not very many. So that's where we use the modeling. And I know you guys hate this diagram, but I hope that now I can convince you that they're useful. This is what you'll hear people calling a spidergram. I don't like to use the spidergram word. We use trace element extended diagram. And we're not plotting everything and anything. And please ask questions. We're plotting our samples relative to the primitive mantle. Now you understand why we do that. We have a reference reservoir, and we try to eliminate our zigzags. And then our elements here are organized in a very given systematic way. It's incompatibility. So those elements on the left lack being in liquids, and those go into minerals. Which means that depending on your reference material, you might see different orders. That's an important point. Yes?
So how do we get the composition of the primitive mantle if we haven't sampled it?
Meteorites and models.
What's the difference between a primitive mantle and a BSE, the bulk silicate earth? Is there any difference between them?
It's a good question. You're going to see them being used the same. The primitive mantle, it's basically the mantle before the crust differentiated, so it should be the same. Well, yeah, it is the same. But the bulk silicate earth, basically what you do, you take the mantle, you no, there is a difference. The bulk silicate earth, you're going to put the crust and you're mixing everything. It's everything that is silicate. So,
yeah.
So the bulk silicate earth is every reservoir on the earth that is containing silicate. That means the mantle and the crust. And yeah, it is the same. The primitive mantle is the mantle from which the crust has differentiated. So they should be equivalent. And I don't know why people use sometimes primitive mantle and sometimes bulk silicate earth. Yeah. So if we look at MOBs, so the megaoceanic rich basalt, you can see that you have a pattern here. And we can explain the different curves, but that's not the point. You can see that the elements that are enriched, that are incompatible, so that do not fit into the minerals, basically into the mantle minerals, are less enriched than the other element. So that's your basalt. Now, the mantle peridotite has basically the same patterns. It is depleted in these incompatible elements. It's depleted because you're not flat relative to the primitive mantle. That's basically why we call it depleted. And the interpretation is that this depletion in the mantle, the upper mantle, the depleted mantle, is related to the fact that all these elements have gone into the continental crust. Why can we say that? And we can model more. If you want to look at that in details, go look at this paper. We're going to spend the rest of the time on that, and I don't want to do that. But we can use various elemental ratios, because elements that belong to the same families in the periodic table will behave the same. And so you can use some of these ratios, like hafnium, samarium, lanthanum, niobium, as fixed, and you can all infer, and that's how you reconstruct your mantle. But so that's, let's move. What do isotopes tell us? Well, you can assume that all the mid-oceanic ridges have a T equals zero. So in our equation here, this disappears. So when you measure your isotopic ratio in your mid-oceanic ridge basalt, you're measuring the isotopic ratio of the source. That's very useful. And when we look at the distribution, and those are summary diagrams from Hoffman, the treatise of geochemistry, when you look at where the mid-oceanic ridge upper mantle plots, it's up here, in a diagram that is neodymium isotopic ratio versus strontium isotopic ratio. We all the way up there. The CHER, Chondritic Uniform Reservoir, is here at zero by definition, because that's how we establish this epsilon neodymium. Do I need to explain that? So neodymium, we have 143 neodymium ratio over 144 neodymium ratio. We measure this ratio, and the variations are very small. So the way we express them is that we normalize this ratio to the ratio in Scheer, in meteorites, and we multiply by 10,000, which is why our variation here are relatively big. If we were looking at our numbers, we would have 0.512638, and there we are 0.5130. So it's a very small variation. That's why we multiply by 10,000 and normalize to Scheer, which means that in this plot with epsilon neodymium, we have Scheer equals zero. My point though here is that I want to emphasize that the fact that the reservoir of the mid-oceanic ridge is up there, and the continental crust occupies this whole area here, and is basically complementary. Question? Do you want to add anything?
He has a question.
Maybe you're just about to get to this, but the OIBs are in between MORB and continental crust. Is that because they contain the signature of continental crust, or is that completely unrelated?
I'll get to that. Okay. And ask it again if I don't answer properly. So if we focus here on our mid-oceanic ridges in this diagram, the point I want to emphasize here, yes? Yeah.
Why do you pick those particular isotopes?
Because we do not have very many. You remember that's whole my whole introduction. You look at the length of the decay constants. You look at where they are distributed into the periodic table. We can also review history and how many evolving through time. We were able to measure strontium and argon isotopes in the 60s, 70s, neodymium in the mid 80s, hafnium in the mid 90s, lead since the mid 60s, and we also want preference bases.
I guess why don't you use like hafnium to lead?
I could use hafnium to lead, except that, and that's what was part of my answer, you don't have that much data published. You do for lead. And the next diagram is actually lead. But hafnium being only established in the mid-90s, you do not have as a thorough database. The point I want to make here is that we always talk about homogeneity of the mid-oceanic ridge reservoir. You can see that depending on the basin you are, you have some difference, essentially in the Indian Ocean that has lower neodymium ratio and higher strontium ratio. And that's a very distinctive signature that I'm not going to go into details, but it makes the Indian Ocean very different from the Atlantic and the Pacific. If we do that, the same thing in lead-lead, we have our lead isotopes, and here we can have two plots, 208, 204, 206, 204, 207, 204, 206, 204. You can see that your Indian Ocean is more hydrogenic than the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean. Different signature. And if you look at more details, you can take fragments of the mid-oceanic ridge system, you're going to see finer variation. But if you compare this now, where am I going? With the oceanic islands, the variations are smaller. That's what we have here. The variation in the mid-oceanic ridge system is smaller than in the oceanic islands. The question is, why is that? And I'll never finish what I've prepared. I borrowed that diagram from Esteban because that's why we use our oceanic islands. And why do we use or oceanic islands. So what we have to deal with, we have all these red things that are large igneous provinces, and I've they all colored in red, except that I have added in orange oceanic flood basalts, and you also have mantle plumes coming into the ocean that have formed continental flood basalts, into the continents that have formed continental flood basalts. We don't want to look at those because to come to the surface, they have to go through the continents, and as the continents are basically loaded with the elements that are interest of us, they completely mess up the message from the mantle. So you guys start fading, and I need you to work a little. So group by pairs of two or three, and what I want you to do is calculate the volume of three of these large igneous province. Take a piece of paper or your computer, you can do that. What we're going to look at is Ontong Java, Kerguelen, and the Columbia River flood basalt. And what this diagram shows is the minimum and the maximum spherical diameters of mantle melting required. 5% of partial melting is the large circle, and 30% of partial melting in the small circle. So I'd like you to get active a little and calculate how much you need, the volume of the mantle that is sampled by these large igneous province. Go on. You guys can do that. It's simple. You love equation. Those are just proportionality rule equation. Form groups of two or three. You have the volume. You assume 5% partial melting or 30% partial melting.
It should be 30.
I just want them to make the difference.
Do something.
And zoom, zoom. I'm giving you the volume of a sphere and pi. It's very simple.
Overthinking this.
Are you guys getting close? It's very simple. Yeah, but that's the point. Does anybody have an answer ready?
I have an answer.
For what?
For Kerguelen, assuming 30% melting, I had 2/3.
Okay.
It's not bad. But I knew it would like back in the envelope.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, this is, and I suggest we move on. I wanted you guys to
get. Radius. Wow, so that's really big.
Yeah, but that's the point I'm making. So it doesn't matter if you have 5% or 30%. First, so what I'm getting at is, in order to produce this volume of magma at the surface, you sample a lot of the mantle. And you sample way more than these spheres, because it's not like you have a sphere that you squeeze and all the magma is coming out.
That's what some people will like.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen. Yeah. It's, you know, you only have a small fraction of your magma coming to the surface. So you actually, what I'm getting at is that by definition, you have to sample way deeper. And it's a very simple calculation, but I hope it makes you realize, so that when we analyze our lavas up there, we have an idea of some composition from deep into the mantle.
How? Oh, sorry. I'll just use it. How confident can we be about whether it's 5 or 30% now?
Esteban.
Does define by the major element composition, and there's a great deal of uncertainty, but it's not going to be 5%.
So it's not 5, it's not 50.
It's probably going to be around 20 to 30.
20 to 30, okay.
So it's going to be the small circle, but even the small circle is gigantic.
Got it.
So they produce mafic lava, and they're supposed to be heavier or denser than normal crustal rocks. Would there be a possibility that we see the surface representation is underbound of what they could have been?
Oh yeah, and you have some erosion, which is also why some people will study the roots of this magma chamber. Those are usually called layer mafic intrusions, like the Bushveld or the Norilsk intrusion. We have all the spectrum. So I'm going to focus, I'm not going to look on Large Igneous Province. I could have talked about that. Those are interesting because you can go back in time. You have some everywhere. But again, when they have gone through the continental crust, the message from the mantle is not as simple as it is when you go on oceanic islands. So they tell us a lot about the chemistry of the mantle. And again, I know you do not like that diagram, but I hope that by now I've built a little confidence in what it can mean. So what we have here, we have the strontium isotopes. So this is a long, a time-integrated signature of the source of the oceanic island. And it's from the decay of rubidium-87 into strontium-87. And on the x-axis here, we have lead-206, lead-204. That's the decay of uranium-238 to lead-206. The mob is here, the gray pluses. And everything else, it's oceanic islands. These oceanic islands are not distributed randomly. They basically define trends towards end members. And we have names for these end members. That is enriched mantle 1, enriched mantle 2, and high mu. The high mu is simply high uranium lead ratio, so you have higher production of 206 lead. Now remember, our isotopic ratios reflect the composition of the source. So when you melt your mantle peridotite here, it with a given strontium-87, strontium-86 ratio, your basalt has the same composition. And that's basically what we're measuring in the oceanic islands. So how can we put all these pieces together with oceanic island here, basically sampled by mantle plume, as nicely imaged in various places, Hawaii, Iceland, and Samoa. Same diagram. What I want to emphasize, and that's in reference to mixing, when all these trends can be modeled as mixing between various end members, and there are not too many end members. First, many of these trends converge to a given composition, which you'll see called as prima for prevalent mantle, foso for focal zone, that's when you put isotopic system in a tetrahedron, they all go towards a focal plane. You'll see it called C. Many of the trends go in there, and if you take N members, you can model how much mixing you have. Now, why do we do that? And why do we have this heterogeneity? I had prepared the mixing equations for you, but I'm going to skip that and we'll give you that as a tutorial. The bottom line is that the mixing, your resulting composition in your lava is proportional to the amount of each component and the concentration of your given element into that component. And what I'm getting at, because the elements we look at are very concentrated in the continental crust, for instance, you only need a very, very little amount, and that's what will make you calculate, of that material to change the isotopic composition of the mantle lava. Now, lead isotopes are very powerful because in a lead-lead diagram, you deal, that's 6-4, 8-4, you're dealing with the same chemical elements. So mixing in this case is a line. In this diagram, strontium neodymium, the mixing can be a line, but only where your N member have the same elemental ratio. You have mixing hyperbolas that are proportional to the elemental ratios in your N members. So that's the advantage of lead. In a lead-lead diagram, mixing is a line. You all fine? Where does the heterogeneity come? Our isotope systems tell us that anything that is low neodymium, and the systematics of the fractionation of the elements, is that anything that has high strontium, low neodymium, is something that has seen the surface, that has an influence of continental crust material or sediments that have come back into the mantle source. So the interpretation is that this material has been brought down into the mantle through subduction zone. And I remember extensive debates 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that how can you say that? You know, we don't know if the slabs go down the subduction zone. Well, now we can clearly see that. But we can also make material mass balance, and we know that between 0.3 and 0.7 cubic kilometers per year of sediment subduct, and about 20 cubic kilometers per year of oceanic crust subduct. So oceanic crust over 3 billion years, it means that about 60 billion cubic kilometers of oceanic crust would have been subducted. That's 5% of the mantle mass. That's becoming significant. And the bottom line is, how could the mantle not be heterogeneous? So we have the mantle heterogeneous because of subduction and recycling, and we also have the mantle, as Sujo showed you, heterogeneous from initial condition. So, and we can see that everywhere when you have rivers coming into the ocean, they're loaded with sediments, and the rivers on Earth contribute 85% of the ocean floor sediments. Now, where do we go from there? I suggest we break for lunch. And I don't know when I'll continue, but sometimes in between now and next weekend, in 10 days. Because otherwise, you guys are going to, I'm going to lose you. Questions, though, before we break for lunch? Or is your stomach crying too much? You all good?
So EM2 is lower continental crust? Was it EM1 or EM2 that was lower continental crust?
It is continental crust. Lower, I don't think we'll argue what it is.
Okay. Well, I was just curious how it gets back into the
You also have delamination. At the bottom of the ocean, you delaminate.
Okay.
You have fragments dropping.
Very nice.